Welcome to this deep dive. Today, we are taking on a mission that requires you to radically re-examine the unseen architecture of your daily life.
We really are, and we're working with a brilliant lecture from Ethics Workshop that pulls apart both the technical and the philosophical definitions of privacy.
Right, because our objective here is to bridge a very specific modern gap. Mm-hmm. We want to look at the massive chasm between how a cold, calculating algorithmic system defines a profoundly human value, like privacy, and how you actually experience that value as you move through the world every single day.
To really understand that gap, we need to look under the hood of how data mechanics operate in a networked society. We have to take a hard look at how technical definitions try to capture messy human behavior.
And we need to explore why the basic assumptions you make about keeping your own life hidden are probably entirely obsolete, especially when we view them through the lens of modern longitudinal data collection.
Exactly. By the time we finish this discussion, you will have to look at your own secrets differently. You're going to question what it actually means to keep a part of yourself hidden in the digital age.
We have to start by establishing the baseline, though. The industry standard that governs how big tech companies and AI developers conceptualize this whole issue.
Which takes us way back to 1964.
Right. To a foundational book by Alan Weston called Privacy and Freedom. Weston essentially pioneered the concept that we now call the control definition of privacy.
And the control definition is beautiful in its simplicity, even if applying it today is, well, a logistical nightmare.
Sure.
Weston basically argues that privacy is your ability to control who has access to your personal information, or, more accurately, your personally identifying information.
Under this framework, an act of privacy is just you deciding who gets to see the data that points directly back to you as a unique individual.
But the source material forces us to make a really sharp distinction here. There is a massive practical difference between personal information and personally identifying information. Right, PII. The Ethics Workshop lecture illustrates this using a hypothetical guy named James Brusseau. Let's think about human height.
Okay.
James Brusseau has a height. You, listening to this, have a height. I have a height.
That biological fact is personal information. But on its own, it tells us absolutely nothing useful.
It gives an algorithm zero predictive power. I mean, imagine you are tasked with finding one specific person in a massive crowded stadium, and the only clue you are given is this person has a height.
You'd be completely lost.
Yeah.
That single data point is utterly useless for filtering out the crowd.
It is personal to the individual, sure, but it does not identify them. It falls totally outside the realm of what an AI system cares about when trying to pinpoint a user.
But watch what happens when we tweak that data point. We change it from he has a height to James Brusseau is exactly 195 centimeters tall.
The entire nature of the information shifts.
Exactly. We go from a universal biological trait to a highly specific distinguishing metric. If you take that 195 centimeter metric back into that crowded stadium, you can immediately ignore almost everyone.
You are physically distinguishing one individual from the masses.
That is the moment information becomes PII. It becomes identifying.
And what is genuinely terrifying is how time and technological progress completely warp these categories. The boundary between what is just a harmless personal fact and what is a highly sensitive identifying metric is constantly moving.
Because it depends entirely on a machine's capacity to aggregate and remember data over time.
Yes. The lecture gives a fantastic, almost absurd-sounding example of this: eating a pizza.
I have to admit, when I first read about the 1994 pizza scenario in the source, it sounded like a joke.
It really does.
The scenario starts with another basic statement. James Brusseau eats.
Which, again, is a universal biological fact, completely useless to a machine. But then the data point gets more specific.
Mm.
James Brusseau ate a slice of pizza on a Tuesday in 1994.
Let's put ourselves back in 1994. The internet was barely a dial-up tone for the lucky few. Nobody had a supercomputer tracking their location in their pocket.
If a company somehow recorded that a specific guy ate a slice of pizza on a random Tuesday back then, that information was considered statistical garbage.
It was completely non-identifying.
Nobody had the storage capacity to keep it, the processing power to cross-reference it, or the algorithmic models to make sense of it. It was just a guy eating lunch.
Fast forward to today, and modern tracking fundamentally changes what that pizza actually means as a piece of information. We are no longer living in a world of isolated, forgotten events.
The pizza is no longer just lunch. Modern algorithms are built to construct massive, lifelong profiles. They quietly gather remote, seemingly microscopic details and hunt for patterns across decades.
So an AI system takes that tiny 30-year-old memory of eating pizza and cross-references it with millions of other tiny data points collected every day since.
Suddenly, that 1994 meal stops being a random historical footnote. It becomes a structural pillar in a predictive model.
The lecture points out something mind-bending here. An algorithm today might look at the type of pizza consumed in 1994, the location, the time of day, and use it to statistically rule out certain geographic or cultural origins for that individual.
For instance, the system might calculate that consuming that specific meal in that specific year makes it statistically highly unlikely that the subject is an immigrant from China.
So this incredibly mundane, utterly boring action taken decades ago is resurrected. Technology takes a harmless memory and weaponizes it to draw a massive demographic conclusion today.
We are talking about machines that can gather, hold, and constantly reevaluate decades of human experience. When an algorithm can turn a 30-year-old slice of pizza into a tool for demographic profiling, we have entered a really blurry labyrinth.
How do we even begin to define the boundaries of what is identifying anymore?
We almost can't. And the lecture pushes this into even more sensitive territory by examining romantic preferences.
The source material contrasts two very simple statements. James Brusseau loves a woman versus James Brusseau loves a man. And we have to step back and look at this strictly through the cold, calculated lens of an algorithm.
We aren't talking about human sociology here. We are talking about mathematical weighting. We are looking at how a machine parses human variables to find a target.
Right.
The lecture points out that being a heterosexual, male-loving woman represents a massive statistical majority. We are talking about roughly 85 to 95% of that specific population.
So if you feed an algorithm, the data point loves a woman, it doesn't actually give the machine much to work with. It is simply too common.
It lacks the statistical rarity needed to aggressively predict highly specific future behaviors or to filter that one individual out from millions of others.
But the alternative statement, loves a man, represents a significantly smaller slice of the overall population. Because homosexuality is statistically rarer on a macro level, an algorithmic system treats that piece of information completely differently.
It assigns it massive weight. It becomes a highly potent predictive indicator. The machine uses it to aggressively forecast future purchasing habits, geographic preferences, voting patterns, and social circles.
This really highlights the complete lack of empathy in these systems. The algorithm doesn't understand political nuance, historical context, or human struggle. It only understands math.
It simply calculates how rare a trait is and assigns predictive utility based on that rarity. This creates a terrifying reality where the boundary of what we desperately need to protect as private is constantly shifting depending on how our behaviors compare to a statistical average.
It makes defining personal boundaries an incredibly blurry moving target.
It really does.
Hearing all of this, looking at how effortlessly machines tear through our history and our preferences, you might feel incredibly powerless. It feels like we are completely exposed to this invisible architecture.
But the source material actually offers a conceptual bridge here that takes some of that power back. It demands that we rethink our foundational definition of the word itself.
Up until now, we've basically treated privacy like a noun. Most people view privacy as a physical object, a treasure chest of secrets that you own, and you try your best to keep locked away in a dark vault.
The lecture challenges us to abandon that idea entirely. We need to stop thinking of privacy as a noun and start understanding it as a verb.
Privacy is not a thing you possess. Privacy is an action you perform. It is something you do.
Viewing it as a verb means privacy is a continuous, real-time negotiation. It is a physical and digital boundary that you are constantly drawing and redrawing.
And the lecture grounds this abstract philosophy with a really visceral, real-world case study about a photography exhibit in New York City.
The speaker in the source describes walking up to this gallery space in New York years ago. The street is probably noisy, there's a crowd, and right at the entrance, blocking the way in, is a very clear sign.
The sign explicitly states that by stepping past it and entering the exhibit, you're giving your formal consent to be photographed by the people inside.
Let's freeze that moment and look at the actual mechanics of what is happening. The physical act of standing on the sidewalk, reading the terms of entry on that sign, and making the conscious choice to step forward, that is privacy in action.
That physical step is the verb.
Yes. It is a real-time, high-stakes negotiation of the boundary between your private self and the public sphere.
In that singular moment of deciding to walk past the sign, You aren't just passively existing, you are actively making a trade. You are choosing to reveal a cascade of personal data to a room full of strangers with cameras.
You are revealing your exact physical location in New York City at that specific timestamp. You are revealing your aesthetic choices through the clothes you decided to wear that day.
You are revealing your social network by exposing whoever you happen to be walking into the gallery with.
The crucial takeaway here is that the person walking in didn't lose their privacy, they executed it.
They performed the act of privacy by deciding exactly where the boundary of their personal information would be drawn for that specific hour of their Tuesday afternoon. They acted as the author of their own public exposure.
Okay, so the source material takes this idea of privacy as an active verb and applies it to what has to be the most counterintuitive example possible.
It actually tries to argue that Kim Kardashian is the most private person in the world.
I have to admit, when I first read that, it sounded like a complete paradox. It sounds absurd on its face. We are talking about an individual whose entire empire is built on hypervisibility.
Her life is consumed globally. You can walk into any grocery store and see intimate details of her daily existence, her family dramas, and her business ventures splashed across magazines.
Her digital footprint is massive and pervasive. She voluntarily reveals more about her morning routine than most of us reveal to our close friends.
But we have to go back to Alan Weston's 1964 control definition and apply it directly to her life. Remember, privacy is the ability to control who has access to your identifying information.
When you view her reality through that strict academic lens, the paradox actually completely resolves itself. She is profoundly private precisely because she exercises absolute, ruthless control over access to her data.
The digital vulnerability we see on our phones is entirely manufactured. It is heavily curated. We are permitted to see her existence, but strictly on the terms she dictates.
Every single social media post, every reality television scene, every paparazzi walk is a deliberate, calculated decision to release a highly specific data point to the public. She is performing the verb of privacy at an elite, almost industrial level.
The source makes a brilliant comparison here by contrasting that carefully curated digital exposure with her physical boundaries. Think about how much you know about her diet or her wardrobe right now.
You could find out what brand of bottled water she drank this morning in 3 seconds.
But imagine you, an uninvited member of the public, tried to physically walk up to the front door of her house in California.
You wouldn't even make it past the gate.
You would be immediately intercepted and physically removed by a highly sophisticated private security apparatus.
The dichotomy is fascinating. She is perfectly willing to show you nearly everything about her existence, provided you access that information through the specific controlled portal she designs.
But the moment you attempt to bypass her control systems, the moment you try to access her life on your terms instead of hers, the boundary becomes an impenetrable fortress.
It perfectly synthesizes everything we have been discussing. A truly private person is not a hermit living off the grid in the woods, hoarding a collection of secrets in a state of constant paranoia.
A private person is an architect of control. They are flawlessly dictating the exact boundary between what is consumed by the public and what remains hidden, and they are constantly negotiating that line in real time.
This whole discussion really requires you, the listener, to look inward and examine your own daily negotiations. If privacy is a verb, a constant action of navigating boundaries, you have to ask yourself how many metaphorical gallery signs you walk past every single day.
Every single time you click accept on a massive cookie banner to read an article, every time you casually allow a new app to track your location in the background, you are standing in front of the New York photography exhibit.
You are actively performing the verb of privacy. You are trading your longitudinal data, your modern equivalent of the 1994 pizza slice, often without fully realizing the terrifying predictive power of the information you are handing over.
You are negotiating your boundaries, but probably without the ruthless architectural control of our extreme celebrity case study.
We've covered a massive amount of ground here. We moved from the foundational ideas of the 1960s to the cold mathematical memory of modern algorithms.
We redefined privacy from a static, hidden object into an active, ongoing negotiation of consent, which brings us to a profound, unresolved dilemma to end on.
We have established that privacy fundamentally relies on your sovereign right to control access to your own data. But AI systems are only growing more sophisticated, and they require vast, unimaginably large oceans of longitudinal data to make their predictive models accurate.
This leads to perhaps the ultimate ethical question in the field of technology right now. What happens when our need for control directly conflicts with the survival and well-being of the human race?
I want you to imagine a near-future scenario. Imagine algorithmic tracking becomes so advanced that it could flawlessly predict and permanently solve our greatest societal crises.
We're talking about an AI system that could spot and eradicate fast-spreading diseases weeks before they become global pandemics. A system that could flawlessly map global supply chains to permanently end systemic starvation and resource scarcity.
But to achieve that utopian level of predictive accuracy, to actually save millions of lives, the algorithm requires the absolute non-negotiable surrender of our control definition of privacy.
It requires the total dissolution of the boundary between the public and the private self. It needs access to everything, all the time.
If faced with that reality, which ethical good must we choose?
Do we cling to our absolute right to keep our own secrets and maintain our personal boundaries, even if it means letting widespread societal suffering continue?
Or do we sacrifice the very concept of personal control on the altar of collective human well-being, turning every intimate detail of our lives into public data points for the sake of saving the world?
It forces us to ask what we truly value more. Our secrets or our collective survival.
That is a very heavy thought.
And that is exactly where we will leave you to draw your own conclusions.